greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed captivates, clarifies, and cuts through the very spirit of evolution and progress. Now, before you ask the session to rescind my job offer, let me remind you that if you're not familiar with those words, that is the monologue given by Michael Douglas as the character Gordon Gekko in the 1987 movie Wall Street. Gordon Gekko is, let's say, an unscrupulous sort of fellow. He is really, really good at making money and increasing the bottom line. The problem is that Gordon Gekko is willing to do almost anything in order to increase that bottom line. And so his life bears out what it is that he's willing to say to a room full of owners and investors, that greed is good. And he goes on to say that greed for everything is good. Greed for life and for love and for money and for knowledge. It's all good because that's what makes us better as people. Brothers and sisters, I think we can all agree that Gordon Gekko is wrong. But I think it doesn't take too much of a shift in perspective for us to see just how easy it is to step away from the good desire of something to the desire of something in the way that Gordon Gekko desires things. To go from something that is, yes, knowledge, love, and life, good, to greed for these things. Right? This is not a big shift. And the church fathers would call this avarice. Avarice and greed are synonymous, but greed tends to be wrapped up solely in the idea of cash, of money. Whereas avarice can be defined this way. Avarice is the heart's disposition that constantly seeks to get and keep more and more of what is mine. Let me say that again. Avarice is the heart's disposition to get and then to keep more and more of what is mine. And so what avarice does is to take certain things and pervert them. What avarice does is to take certain things that intrinsically are not bad and to make them into things that are ultimate. This is why it's a vice, because it's not merely a sin. It's a pattern. It's a way of living out. It's a way of actually your heart bearing out the very things that you hold dear. And so this morning we're going to look at avarice in three ways. We're going to look at avarice to see what it perverts within us, what it patently ignores around us, and what we have to do to put it to death. What it perverts within us, what it patently ignores around us, and what we have to do to put it to death. We're in Luke 12 this morning. We're going to read verses 13 to 21 and then skip down to verse 32 and read through verse 34. If you have your Bibles, please turn there, stand for the reading of God's Word if you are able. Hear the word of the Lord. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old and with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will be your heart also. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. What avarice perverts within us? That's where we're starting. And, you know, it's an interesting place to start because the storyline that we have here is sort of an awkward insertion into the narrative, right? Luke has been telling the story of Jesus' travels to Jerusalem, 951, that's what we learn. Jesus' face is set towards Jerusalem. And so everything that's happening since that point has been happening as Jesus is traveling with his disciples, both the 12 and a larger group, towards, ultimately, his death. And Jesus has been teaching, and he's been evangelizing, he's been sending out the 72, he's given many parables, he's had multiple interactions with people and with the religious and legal authorities of his day, many of which did not go well, but many of which also resulted in the parables you're familiar with, like the parable of the Good Samaritan in chapter 10. But this particular parable comes from an interruption. Right? This parable is not brought on because Jesus is teaching particularly on the subject of avarice. It comes on rather because Jesus has just finished teaching his disciples that there is no need for you to be anxious about what you should say. The Spirit will lead you. Trust in the Spirit. And then from out of nowhere, from out of the crowd, which by the way, if you look at 12:1, says is now many thousands, okay, comes one solitary voice. Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus uses this as a launching pad to then talk about avarice, to in fact warn the entirety of these thousands against covetousness, which can also be translated here, avarice. Why? Because the man's question is more than a matter of speech, it's a matter of the heart. Because what's at the heart of the request reveals what's in the heart of the one who makes it. It seems on its face like a very simple request. Sir, you who have authority to do these things, I need some help because my brother won't give me what's mine. Okay, a little brazen maybe, but nothing wrong with it. And yet, it is this request that Jesus uses to launch into avarice for this reason. Because avarice perverts the way we see and experience life. Avarice perverts the way we see and experience life. This man approaches Jesus, whom he does not know, approaches Jesus, who has been in the context of giving a fairly private, if you will, teaching to his disciples, interrupts him, asks him to stop doing whatever he's doing so that this man might get some sort of legal rendering or judgment from Jesus. And he does this in such a way that what is evident and the reason why what Jesus can see to the heart of this man is this, that this man's view of life and what it takes to live well is tied to an inheritance that Jesus has to give him because he can't get it on his own, right? It's tied to money that his brother won't give him. And therefore, what we see is that avarice has perverted the way that he looks at his life. It's perverted the way that he sees where life is to be found and how it is to be experienced and maintained. This man calls Jesus teacher, but has absolutely no interest in learning. Absolutely no interest in approaching Jesus in a manner that would respect the title. It is a title without substance here. He might as well have said, hey, dude that can help me get paid, because that's what he's done. He simply called out to somebody who might have some legal standing more so than his that can arbitrate, that can make a judgment that will get him what he wants. Is he starving? No. Is he in dire need? Not that we can tell. Is he in some way being oppressed? No. He just wants money. That's it. He wants what he feels is his. He finds more life, you could say, in an inheritance that will be divided and a relationship that will also then divide than he does in remaining in unity and harmony with his brother. The very thing that Psalm 133 calls good and pleasant. Here is a man whose desires and whose view of life have been perverted by the need to live in a way that only money, in his opinion, can make. And this is true of the farmer in the parable as well. Look at the way that the farmer talks. The entirety of the farmer's speech is in monologue. right? There's no real conversation here. It's just all internal. It's like we're getting a picture into his thought life. And so the most commonly repeated words in this section are I and my. I will do this. I will tear down. I will build. My crops, my barns, my goods. And you think, well, I mean, it's a monologue. You expect I and my in a monologue. And that's true. I mean, those who talk to themselves in the third person are crazy. But again, what we're seeing here is Jesus is crafting a setting to show once more that what's going on here is deeper than the surface. That what's going on here reflects not just a habit of speech, but a habit of heart, a habit of living, a pattern that has been perverted because this man's view of life is luxury and ease are really where it's at. Ultimately, what this guy is looking for is what he finally gets with this surplus of goods. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. Or, translated slightly differently, celebrate. He just wants life to be one big party. That's it. And so avarice has taken the desire for good things, the desire for crops, the desire for a good yield, and has twisted them to be that which not only builds but sustains life. Brothers and sisters, we could say this another way, that avarice perverts our desires and our life ultimately by connecting our identities to our things. Ultimately, what avarice does is it causes us to find both definition and defense in our things. And look, this doesn't have to be bank accounts. This doesn't have to be barns. This doesn't have to be those things that are actually tangibly saleable for money. For some of us, these things are far more subtle than that. For some of us, these things are reputation. For some of us, these things may be the letters that follow our name. For some of us, these things might be things that nobody else would see as in any way out of order or out of bounds. Things maybe that have sentiment. Things maybe that are heirlooms. Things that we put away in tiny boxes that nobody knows about, nobody else is allowed to touch. This too is avarice. Because ultimately what's at stake here is you are being, in one sense, defined and defended by the very things you claim to own. That what you claim to own ends up owning you. Right? This farmer, for all of his good, for all of his barn building and surplus storing, is ultimately incapable of letting go of these things. He was rich before the surplus. That's what Jesus says. The land of a rich man produced plentifully. He was rich beforehand, but this surplus gives him something extra. It puts him into the next circle, right? Now he's fun in the sun, rich. Now he's able to hit the next circle of life that he's been striving and working so hard maybe to get to this whole time. Now he can't just attend the parties, he can throw them. And because attending these parties and throwing these parties and relaxing and feasting and drinking are dependent upon having the surplus, he has to guard it because you will guard the things that you believe guard you. You will guard and defend the things that you believe defend you. This man ultimately finds the defense for his future, the defense for his life, the defense for that which he wants to be and imagines himself to be. He will defend those things. You're not going to give them away, because to give them away would be to give away then that very status. It would be to give away that very definition of himself, and he can't do that. If you're defined by your goods and you give them away, then you give away yourself. That's the problem here. This man has more than enough. He was rich before, and then he's given more on top of that. And what's his first goal? To build bigger barns. To make sure that this is houseable, that it's keepable, that this is somehow maintainable, that I can not only get but keep more and more that I can call mine. The farmer in this parable is guilty of avarice. Look at verse 19 and the way he phrases this. He says to himself, he says, "Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years." Relax. "For many years," he says. He has made his future dependent upon what he has laid up. In other words, the security and the defense for this way of life that he so badly wants is in the things that he thinks will guarantee it, in the surplus, in the extra, in the little bit more. But the tragedy is that the other thing avarice perverts is the truth. That avarice is all a lie. That avarice is founded upon lies. Not only because it suggests to you that it can define and defend you, that it can find you those things that will ultimately satisfy you, but also because it tells you that you can own something. And this is dangerous. And this is dangerous especially for us in 21st century America, where ownership really means something. This is dangerous for us who often confuse and conflate the American dream for the gospel. This is dangerous for us who would say, this is mine, in the same way that we would say, our boots are ours. C.S. Lewis says it well when he says this. He's writing in Screwtape Letters as the demon and says, we, the demons, teach them not to notice the different senses of the possessive pronoun, the finely graded differences that run from my boots through my dog, my servant, my wife, my father, my master, and my country to my God. They can be taught to reduce all these senses to that of my boots, the my of ownership. And all this time, the joke is that the word mine, in its fully possessive sense, cannot be uttered by a human being about anything. They will find in the end, never fear, to whom their time, their souls, and their bodies really belong. Certainly not to them, whatever happens. So what avarice perverts within us is a sense that what needs to be true and what is true is that we can actually own these things, right? This man, this farmer, is so confident in the fact that this surplus and these barns give him years. Give him years. He's not only confident that it gives him status and ability, it actually prolongs his life because it's his and because he knows how to manage them. But the lie of avarice is that we can keep without being kept, that we can own without ourselves being owned, that somehow we can be possessors without being possessed by. And avarice whispers to us very subtly, very softly, it's okay. I'm yours. It's okay. You can use me how you want to because I'm yours. You deserve this. You own this. You've got this. That's the subtle lie of avarice. Brothers and sisters, how often do we sound a bit like this farmer? How many of us struggle with believing the lie of ownership? How many of us find ourselves so attached to the things that we know biblically have been given by God, but they're really ours? I mean, he's given them to us. That's like divine sanction for ownership, right? How many of us have struggled with playing the game of, this is what I would do if I had? Maybe like a couple months ago when Powerball got to $1 billion. It was a good game. But it's a small step from game playing to greed making and from pretending to perverting. And so, brothers and sisters, I want to warn you, to warn us, that it is not merely the wealthy who are avaricious. It is not merely a pattern of life for those who already have. It is a pattern of life for anyone who desires to have in a way that makes him or her the owners of something that defends and defines them. That's avarice. And it is a subtle and dangerous pattern. But it's subtle and dangerous not only because of what it perverts, it's subtle and dangerous because of what it ignores. And so the second thing I want to look at this morning is, what does avarice patently ignore around us? And I think what we can see in this particular parable is this, that what avarice patently ignores around us is the claims of justice. And you say, justice isn't an issue in this parable. There is no issue of justice in this parable. And you're right. But that's the issue. See, here's the thing. You hear this parable through ears that are so far removed from the original audience that in some ways it's hard to identify how this impacts the people to whom Jesus is speaking. Because Jesus isn't speaking to the farmer, right? He's not speaking by and large to the wealthy. He's speaking to crowds of people who have come from local villages who are probably peasants and tenants and workers on farms similar to this one. But what he's done is he's painted this picture. He said, the man who has done this has worked in isolation from everyone else around him to achieve only the things that he might get to celebrate only his own life. This man has taken no thought to the economy of the village and the farms that would be affected by what he has done. This man has given no thought to how it is that his feasting might be causing famine for others. None of that has crossed the mind of this farmer. And in all the while, in the background, is ringing the commands of the Old Testament, ringing the Word of God that says things like this: if among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it might be. Or, even for the foreigner, God has said, and when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, nor shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. See, the claims of justice are about righting wrongs. They're about feeding the hungry, about giving drink to the thirsty, about clothing the naked, about visiting the sick and imprisoned, about caring for the fathers and the widow. This man's monologue reveals this, that none of those thoughts have crossed his mind because these things are his and he can do whatever he wants to. Because these things are his and what really matters is the fact that he gets to live off of his own work the way he wants to. God's gift of plenty was to lead his people to practice justice for all people, not to practice happiness for oneself alone. That does not mean God does not want you to be happy, but it does mean that the kind of happiness you would seek can never be separate from what others look like and how their needs are being met. Avarice ignores the claims of justice. Look, there is nothing wrong with the farmer's shrewdness. As a businessman, he's really bright. I mean, he doesn't just build other barns. He builds bigger barns in replace of the smaller ones. Why does that matter? Well, because if he builds other barns, he has to take up additional land that could be used for farming and can continue to generate income of a sort, but he doesn't. He knows his land and what his trade well enough to say, you know what, we're just going to keep using the same plot of land we've been using. We're just going to expand the size of the barn a little bit, and that way we can house everything. That's good business. This man does a good business idea when he decides it's better if we have these things stored than to leave them out in the open, right? If we leave all of this prone to weather and animals and just your average thievery that happens everywhere in the world, these things won't last, so we'll store them. But when your business savvy and your shrewdness are disconnected from the needs of your neighbors, from the needs of your employees, from the needs of your friends, and from the needs of anybody else who bears the image of God, you are struggling with the pattern of avarice. The point is not to live on crusts of bread. The point is not for you to live threadbare lives. The point is not for you to give every single thing you've ever owned away and then say, see God, look what I've done. But the point of it all is to ask this: do the things that we have too large a claim on our hearts? And therefore, do the things that we have prevent us from doing the kind of justice that God requires? That's what we have to ask. It's what we have to deal with. When St. Basil preached a sermon on this passage, he said it this way. He said, it's the hungry one's bread that you hoard, the naked one's cloak that you retain, the needy one's money you withhold. In a modernization of this and attempting perhaps to make this more poignant, although that hurts by itself, Rebecca DeYoung modernizes this and says, your second donut this morning belong to the child who came to school with no breakfast. The new winter coat hanging in your closet next to four other coats now out of style belongs to the homeless person you passed on your way downtown last weekend. And the money you've saved for retirement is the difference between subsistence and starvation for the sweatshop workers who made your favorite hiking boots that you've only worn twice. I know, dangerous ground. Oh, be careful, Pastor. Brothers and sisters, I'm trying to be as careful as I can be. But here is the reality. I'm not telling you how much you can have. I'm not telling you how much you should have. I'm not telling you not to enjoy the fruit of your labors, but I am telling you this, that if enjoying the fruit of your labors prevents or prohibits or even in any way lessens what you ought to be doing to satisfy the claims of justice, you'd better rethink. You had better rethink. Brothers and sisters, I'm asking you to consider with me how it is that we use even our common sense, how it is that we use even biblical language, even our doctrines, to excuse ourselves from having to satisfy the claims of justice. I mean, I know I should give to charity, and I want to, but you know, I just can't find a charity that really gives a big enough percentage to the need that it claims. That's savvy. That's worth researching. But if it prohibits you from giving at all, it's a sin. It's avarice. Or how about this? I could have picked up that person on the side of the road. I saw their car was broken down, but it's really tough. You've ever tried to get out of Dallas traffic? It's tough, right? And let's be honest, you can't really trust people these days. There's one thing that good doctrine of total depravity has taught me, it's that nobody's good. There's nothing like using good doctrine for bad practices. But we do it, don't we? Or how about this one? Yeah, I want to give to the needy. I just want to make sure they're the right kind of needy. I want to make sure that they're the deserving kind of needy. You know, I can't just give something to somebody and then not know if they're going to misuse it. Again, there is a particular line in most of these statements that bears, if you will, something of wisdom, perhaps, something of economy, something maybe even of stewardship. But I think the problem here is not with whether or not we are being wise, but the fact that almost all of those statements end with my something. Right? Therein lies your problem. Therein lies our struggle. It's not that we don't want to give, it's that we don't want to give my money. Right? It's not that we don't want to help people, but if we're going to help them, we need to know that my stuff is being used well or rightly. It's tough to part with the things that we consider our own. And so our excuses go on, and so the demands of justice go unmet. Avarice positions us to become concerned with justice only when injustice is done to us. Consider the man who interrupts Jesus, who begins this entire teaching. He says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And in so doing, he has interrupted a private conversation. He has assumed his ability to call upon the uses of a rabbi, whether or not that rabbi knows who he is. He has put his own voice so far above the din of thousands of people that he has literally exposed to thousands that his case is worth hearing. Who cares about theirs? And he has basically said this to Jesus: "My brother's not being fair. You know the law. I'm supposed to get what's mine. This is a justice issue." And all the while, he circumvents the very claims of justice that he would have Jesus follow. Brothers and sisters, beware. Beware of believing that somehow the justice or injustice is done to you also then alleviates you of the responsibility of following through on the claims of God's justice upon you. Because the last thing that avarice patently ignores is God himself. I mean, why wouldn't it, right? God, especially the biblical God, but any God, is just something else to make a claim upon you. Just somebody else you got to share with. He's going to tell you to do things with your money. He's going to even ask you to give him some of your money. But it's yours, and you shouldn't have to. That's what avarice says. That's what this farmer says. Nowhere in this entire parable does God come mentioned until God intrudes into the story. God has to actually step into the story as a first person to enter into dialogue with this man to say to him, "You fool." And fool, the word that God uses here to describe this man, is a word ultimately that describes those who act and who make decisions without ever considering God and without the wisdom of understanding the possibility of destruction. That's what the word fool here means. Here is one who has gone forward with all of his activity without a care for justice, without a care for anyone, and without a care for God. And we see this perhaps most clearly in the way he says, "I will say to my soul." And look, you don't have to get metaphysical here. Soul here does not necessarily meaning that part of you that separates at death. It's just a word for life. He literally believes that his life is his own. And so when God comes, God has the last word not only to identify him for what he is, the fool, but also to remind him in great verbal irony, your soul is required of you. To say to the man exactly what he'd said to himself, only to say so in such a way that it becomes obvious that this man's soul belonged to God and always had. And so God leaves him with a question that is in two parts. Says, "And these things you have prepared, whose will they be?" These things you have prepared, says God, and makes the observation that what you have done is to prepare many things, goods and crops and barns and fields, but you've never once considered your actual relationship to me. You've never once prepared yourself for this. And so the consequences of this are these, that your soul is required of you. And everything you had will belong to another. Everything you had will belong to another. The farmer denies God's good by looking at the plentiful yield not as a gift, but as a given. And the minute he does so, he forgets that God is the giver of all good things, that all good and perfect things come down from the Father of lights who resides in heaven, with whom there is no turning like shadows. And so, this man, in denying God's claim upon himself, shows us the kind of ignoring that avarice has its effect upon all of us, unless we put it to death. Brothers and sisters, yours and mine heart are idol-making factories. Your and my heart are those which will seek to be alleviated from fear and alleviated from stress and want by whatever means necessary, unless we put avarice to death. So how do we do it? Well, to put it quite simply, unless or if we are going to look at all of the vices as storylines, all of the vices as narratives, all of the vices as controlling stories for our lives, then the only way to put avarice to death is to find a better story. The only way to put avarice to death is to find a story that is not just better in hearing, but it's better in living. To find a story that promises you not just stuff, but eternal stuff. That promises you not just things, but a person. This is the only way to see avarice put to death in you. You must have an encounter with the Jesus of the gospel, the one who owns everything, but who gave everything up because he loves you. Do you know that? Do you know that that's the gospel? The gospel isn't Jesus died so you could be loved. The gospel is Jesus died because he loves you. Don't confuse those ideas. This is the story you've been given. You want a better story? It doesn't get any better than this. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You wanted riches? You got them. You want streets of gold and gates made of pearl? You've got them. But brothers and sisters, those things don't exist apart from Jesus. You need the cross of the Lamb of God and the claws of the Lion of God. The former to satisfy God's demands for justice, and the latter to strip you bare of all that would rise up in your heart that would seek to claim, this is mine and I must have it. You may remember that scene in Voyage of the Dawn Treader where Eustace, fairly snotty and unlikable fellow, finds himself amidst a dragon's treasure. There's no dragon. And so he begins to dream of what it would be like if he actually had this at his disposal. And then he puts on one of the bracelets and falls asleep. And then he wakes up and he realizes his arm hurts. Why does his arm hurt so badly? And he looks down and it's because his arm has gotten so big. And it's gotten so big because he realizes he is the dragon. He's become the dragon. And it has to be Aslan who will free him from this. And Aslan comes to him and says to him, I'm going to have to undress you. Which is a very nice way of saying, I'm going to have to skin you alive. And that's what he does. And as Eustace is relaying this story to his teammates, to his friends, he says, the very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. Brothers and sisters, that's what it's going to take to put avarice to death, to have the words and the love and the grace of Jesus rip into your heart to replace the things that are currently there, to get rid of the loves that you have there that you know full well aren't worthy of your love, to remember that it is Jesus who defines you. You're his little flock. You're his sheep. You're his people. You are the children of God. And it is Jesus who defends you. You're his rod and his staff. They comfort you. He has laid down his life that you might have life. All else that would claim, I will give you life and I will give you satisfaction and I will make you the person you want to be, are lies and insufficient, and they will leave you craving more, and you will become the addict that avarice will always make you, unless you will trust and believe that the gospel and that the Jesus that it proclaims are big enough and good enough to leave you wanting no more. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, amen.